Dred Scott versus Sanford, U.S. Supreme Court, December term, 1856. Mr. Chief Justice Taney delivered the opinion of the court. This case has been twice argued. After the argument at the last term, differences of opinion were found to exist among the members of the court, and as the questions in controversy are of the highest importance, and the court was at that time much pressed by the ordinary business of the term, it was deemed advisable to continue the case and direct a re-argument on some of the points in order that we might have an opportunity of giving the whole subject a more deliberate consideration. It has accordingly been again argued by counsel and considered by the court, and I now proceed to deliver its opinion. There are two leading questions presented by the record. One, had the Circuit Court of the United States jurisdiction to hear and determine the case between these parties? And two, if it had jurisdiction, is the judgment it has given erroneous or not? The plaintiff in error, who was also the plaintiff in the court below, was, with his wife and children, held as slaves by the defendant in the state of Missouri. And he brought this action in the Circuit Court of the United States for that district to assert the title of himself and his family to freedom. The declaration is in the form usually adopted in that state to try questions of this description, and it contains the averment necessary to give the court jurisdiction that he and the defendant are citizens of different states, that is, that he is a citizen of Missouri and the defendant a citizen of New York. The defendant pleaded in abatement to the jurisdiction of the court that the plaintiff was not a citizen of the state of Missouri, as alleged in his declaration, being a Negro of African descent whose ancestors were of pure African blood and who were brought into this country and sold as slaves. To this plea, the plaintiff demurred, and the defendant joined in demur. The court overruled the plea and gave judgment that the defendant should answer over. And he thereupon put in sundry pleas in bar, upon which issues were joined, and at the trial the verdict and judgment were in his favor, whereupon the plaintiff brought this writ of error. Before we speak of the pleas in bar, it will be proper to dispose of the questions which have arisen on the plea in abatement. That plea denies the right of the plaintiff to sue in a court of the United States for the reasons therein stated. If the question raised by it is legally before us, and the court should be of opinion that the facts stated in it disqualify the plaintiff from becoming a citizen, in the sense in which that word is used in the Constitution of the United States, then the judgment of the Circuit Court is erroneous and must be reversed. It is suggested, however, that this plea is not before us, and that as the judgment in the court below on this plea was in favor of the plaintiff, he does not seek to reverse it or bring it before the court for revision by his writ of error, and also that the defendant waived this defense by pleading over and thereby admitted the jurisdiction of the court. But in making this objection, we think the peculiar and limited jurisdiction of courts of the United States has not been adverted to. This peculiar and limited jurisdiction has made it necessary in these courts to adopt different rules and principles of pleading, so far as jurisdiction is concerned, from those which regulate courts of common law in England and in the different states of the Union, which have adopted the common law rules. In these last-mentioned courts, where their character and rank are analogous to that of a circuit court of the United States, in other words, where they are what the law terms courts of general jurisdiction, they are presumed to have jurisdiction unless the contrary appears. No averment in the pleadings of the plaintiff is necessary in order to give jurisdiction. If the defendant objects to it, he must plead it specially, and unless the fact on which it relies is found to be true by a jury or admitted to be true by the plaintiff, the jurisdiction cannot be disputed in an appellate court. Now, it is not necessary to inquire whether in courts of that description a party who pleads over in bar when a plea to the jurisdiction has been ruled against him does or does not waive his plea, nor whether upon a judgment in his favor on the pleas in bar and a writ of error brought by the plaintiff, the question upon the plea in abatement would be open for revision in the appellate court. Cases that may have been decided in such courts or rules that may have been laid down by common law pleaders can have no influence in the decision in this court, because under the Constitution and laws of the United States, the rules which govern the pleadings in its courts and questions of jurisdiction stand on different principles and are regulated by different laws. This difference arises, as we have said, from the peculiar character of the government of the United States. For although it is sovereign and supreme in its appropriate sphere of action, yet it does not possess all the powers which usually belong to the sovereignty of a nation. Certain specified powers enumerated in the Constitution have been conferred upon it, and neither the legislative, executive, nor judicial departments of the government can lawfully exercise any authority beyond the limits marked out by the Constitution. And in regulating the judicial department, the cases in which the courts of the United States shall have jurisdiction are particularly and specifically enumerated and defined, and they are not authorized to take cognizance of any case which does not come within the description therein specified. Hence, when a plaintiff sues in a court of the United States, it is necessary that he should show in his pleading that the suit he brings is within the jurisdiction of the court, and that he is entitled to sue there. And if he omits to do this, and should by any oversight of the circuit court obtain a judgment in his favor, the judgment would be reversed in the appellate court for want of jurisdiction in the court below. The jurisdiction would not be presumed, as in the case of a common law English or state court, unless the contrary appeared. But the record, when it comes before the appellate court, must show affirmatively that the inferior court had authority under the Constitution to hear and determine the case. And if the plaintiff claims a right to sue in a circuit court of the United States, under that provision of the Constitution which gives jurisdiction in controversies between citizens of different states, he must distinctly aver in his pleading that they are citizens of different states, and he cannot maintain his suit without showing that fact in the pleadings. This point was decided in the case of Bingham versus Cabot, and ever since adhered to by the court. And in Jackson versus Ashton, it was held that the objection to which it was open could not be waived by the opposite party because the consent of parties could not give jurisdiction. It is needless to accumulate cases on this subject. Those already referred to, and the cases of Capron versus Van Noorden and Montalette versus Murray, are sufficient to show the rule of which we have spoken. The case of Capron versus Van Noorden strikingly illustrates the difference between a common law court and a court of the United States. If, however, the fact of citizenship is averred in the declaration and the defendant does not deny it and put it in issue by plea and abatement, he cannot offer evidence at trial to disprove it, and consequently cannot avail himself of the objection in the appellate court unless the defect should be apparent from some other part of the record. For if there is no plea and abatement, and the want of jurisdiction does not appear in any other part of the transcript brought up by the writ of error, the undisputed averment of citizenship in the declaration must be taken in this court to be true. In this case, the citizenship is averred, but it is denied by the defendant in the manner required by the rules of pleading, and the fact upon which the denial is based is admitted by the demurrer. And if the plea and demurrer and judgment of the court below upon it are before us upon this record, the question to be decided is whether the facts stated in the plea are sufficient to show that the plaintiff is not entitled to sue as a citizen in a court of the United States. We think they are before us. The plea and abatement and the judgment of the court upon it are a part of the judicial proceedings in the circuit court and are there recorded as such. And a writ of error always brings up to the superior court the whole record of the proceedings in the court below. And in the case of the United States versus Smith, this court said that the case being brought up by writ of error, the whole record was under consideration of this court. And this being the case in the present instance, the plea and abatement is necessarily under consideration. And it becomes, therefore, our duty to decide whether the facts stated in the plea are or are not sufficient to show that the plaintiff is not entitled to sue as a citizen in a court of the United States. This is certainly a very serious question, and one that now, for the first time, has been brought for decision before this court. But it is brought here by those who have a right to bring it, and it is our duty to meet and decide it. The question is simply this. Can a Negro whose ancestors were imported into this country and sold as slaves become a member of the political community formed and brought into existence by the Constitution of the United States, and as such become entitled to all the rights and privileges and immunities guaranteed by that instrument to the citizen, one of which rights is the privilege of suing in a court of the United States in the cases specified in the Constitution? It will be observed that the plea applies to that class of persons only whose ancestors were Negroes of the African race and imported into this country and sold and held as slaves. The only matter in issue before the court, therefore, is whether the descendants of such slaves, when they shall be emancipated, or who are born of parents who had become free before their birth, are citizens of a state, in the sense in which the word citizen is used in the Constitution of the United States. And this being the only matter in dispute on the pleadings, the court must be understood as speaking in this opinion of that class only, that is, of those persons who are the descendants of Africans who were imported into this country and sold as slaves. The situation of this population was altogether unlike that of the Indian race. The latter, it is true, formed no part of the colonial communities and never amalgamated with them in social connections or in government. But although they were uncivilized, they were yet a free and independent people, associated together in tribes or nations and governed by their own laws. Many of these political communities were situated in territories to which the white race claimed the ultimate right of dominion, but that claim was acknowledged to be subject to the right of the Indians to occupy it as long as they thought proper, and neither the English nor colonial governments claimed or exercised any dominion over the tribe or nation by whom it was occupied, nor claimed the right to the possession of the territory until the tribe or nation consented to cede it. These Indian governments were regarded and treated as foreign governments, so much so as if an ocean had separated the red man from the white. And their freedom has constantly been acknowledged from the time of the first emigration to the English colonies to the present day by the different governments which succeeded each other. Treaties have been negotiated with them and their alliance sought for in war, and the people who compose these Indian political communities have always been treated as foreigners not living under our government. It is true, of course, that the course of events has brought the Indian tribes within the limits of the United States under subjugation to the white race, and it has been found necessary for their sake as well as our own to regard them as in a state of pupillage and to legislate a certain extent over them and the territory they occupy. But they may, without doubt, like the subjects of any other foreign government, be naturalized by the authority of Congress and become citizens of a state and of the United States. And if an individual should leave his nation or tribe and take up his abode among the white population, he would be entitled to all the rights and privileges which would belong to an emigrant from any other foreign people.